Tune in to Copenhagen Daily every day from 11 a.m. till noon throughout the UN Climate Conference on Resonance 104.4 FM.
With many other people to send a message to world leaders who are at Copenhagen to get together and agree a credible deal for the planet to reduce carbon emissions. And I'm here to send a message to them that we really need to see some action fast. You know, the science is there, the science is believable, and we know that it's we know what's happening, and we can see the warning signs that the planet's giving us. Such as the rapid reduction of Arctic sea ice, which is way beyond the estimated reduction in sea ice that the IPCC originally predicted. You know, things are happening very quickly, and we need to take these warning signs, take them as and heed what the planet is telling us, and really change the way society functions, change our sort of energy foundation away from dirty fossil fuel energies, so that we embrace clean, reliable, renewable technologies, which we have huge abundant resources for, but we're just not harnessing that power at the moment. So I think that really this gathering of people needs to send a message, is trying to send a message to world leaders that, you know, we need to see action really rapidly so that we can stay back from pushing the tipping points, which would trigger runaway climate change on a massive scale and make it very difficult for human society to exist on this planet.
Just in a few words, what do you want to...
Seems like guy's trying to sleep. I'd like to see a rapid uptake of renewable energy across the world. I'd like to see a large amount of money made available from the developed world to the developing world to help them mitigate and adapt, mainly to adapt to climate change. And also, I'd like to see targets for biological sequestration distributed across nations, so that year by year they have to create so much CO2 sequestration through care and support of their natural systems.
Something like a demonstration like this, I think, does have an impact on governments.
Is no answer.
And what do you hope to see from the Copenhagen conference?
Well, I suppose, ideally, a global government sign-up to reducing carbon emissions.
I believe that people power can change change things for the better. It's all about climate justice.
So what would you like to see from the Copenhagen Climate Summit? What's your one main hope?
An absolute serious wartime style effort towards cutting carbon emissions out of the atmosphere completely, and so it can recover, because it seems so serious that that's the only option that we've got.
Do you think that you know, this event can affect the outcome?
It has to. It's the only hope we've got, isn't it? This is apart from breaking the law and having riots. This is the most sane way to do things, and you've got to believe these protests can make a difference. So you have to believe that they can change things.
You're from India, but you live in the UK. You know, do you think that gives you a different perspective on the issue of climate change?
That's right, yes. It is a completely different scenario where India is progressing and developing and is following the Western formula of using as much as energy, polluting as much as, whereas in West it has seen the effect and the outcome of the pollution, and now are thinking of how to cut the emissions, whereas India is still doing the same formula of producing mass emissions. So I can see both countries how they approach.
One of the things you point to in the report is the risk of a subprime carbon crash. How serious do you think that threat is? Again, Alexandra Gale in the Guardian saying there are no complex instruments creating shadow finance. Carbon trading uses essentially the same simple market instruments as trading in gold, wheat and coal.
I think it's interesting that she's calling them simple market instruments, where those kind of those financial derivative products are recognised even by people within the finance industry themselves as incredibly complex and incredibly dangerous. So Warren Buffett, who's a financier himself, a US financier, labelled them as financial weapons of mass destruction. So I think to start with, the fact that she's saying that those products are simple is very contentious. They are tools which allow companies that have to buy and sell emissions permits and credits, because their emissions are covered by a cap, to kind of hedge their bets on changes in price. And they are kind of like promises to purchase or to sell a certain amount of credits or permits at a given amount at a given time in the future. What's actually happening is you're seeing the investment banks and the other kind of actors who provide these products increasingly packaging them into more and more kind of complex consolidated instruments, very similar to the way that the subprime mortgages were consolidated in the sort of processes that led up to the subprime mortgage bubble. The other big problem which is kind of linked into this is the problem in actually valuing an offset credit. So it's incredibly hard, if not impossible, to actually prove that a credit from an offsetting scheme is equivalent to a certain amount of emissions reductions. Again, in the same in parallel with the kind of subprime mortgage issues, where there is big risks about people being able to ever pay back certain kind of dodgy debts which were taken on, there are big questions over whether certain offset credits will ever be sort of equivalent to what they're supposed to be. And then these are being increasingly packaged up, as I said, into more and more complex products. There's lots and lots of money pouring into this. In an article yesterday, I think the head of the European Climate Exchange said that carbon products were really one of the most profitable kind of areas for traders at the moment. And we are really, really concerned that with those different factors taken into account, that there is a very big risk that carbon could become the new kind of speculative bubble, the new subprime. But the difference really in this case is that if that does happen, if governments really drive the expansion of carbon trading, and there's very little regulation of the kind of involvement of financial actors and the way that the products are bought and sold, if there is a bubble is created and if it bursts, then the implications aren't just around losses of jobs and problems for businesses and big problems, economic problems that we've seen in the recent crash, but actually it could fundamentally undermine our ability to bring down emissions in the kind of time periods that we have in order to avoid catastrophic climate change.
And despite the kind of economic crash that we've had over the last couple of years, there doesn't seem to be any real increased appetite for governments to regulate against these complex financial instruments in the kind of mainstream financial market. So you do wonder what appetite there is for regulating the carbon markets.
Yeah, absolutely, and it would seem very little appetite at the moment. And it's really concerning already. I mean, this is already quite a substantial market. Kind of the EU market worth around, you know, $90 billion in 2008. And the fact that already there are many, many different layers of overlapping regulations. So national governments have some responsibilities under the European Emissions Trading Scheme, but then some of it is regulated by the United Nations under the Clean Development Mechanism. Some of it is regulated under the European Commission. And already this is an incredibly complex structure where there are already some gaps. So the UK Financial Services Authority has already said that some of the financial products which are being used in carbon trading kind of fall outside of the European Commission's regulations on financial products. But it does look like there's very little appetite, very little discussion about actually trying to ensure that there's coherence, that people actually understand what's going on in the trading systems. I mean, it's incredibly hard even to actually find out how much carbon is traded here in the UK and here in London, which is a major hub for the carbon market. This is because actually only a small proportion of the trading actually takes place in exchanges where companies have to be registered and there's a certain amount of transparency and accountability. A lot of the trading is taking place over the counter in the large investment banks, and it's incredibly hard to get any information at all about the volumes and the types of trading that's taking place. There are some signals in the US that the United States government is actually considering increasing its regulation of this over-the-counter trading in financial derivatives products, not just in relation to carbon, but more widely, and that would affect the carbon trading. But overall, there's very little discussion. It's very concerning. There's very little discussion here in the EU about the need to kind of plug that gap.
One thing I'd like to pick up on, though, is the EU package for funding.
Yeah.
And the kind of duplicity that we're seeing. We're getting Gordon Brown making statements saying the government recognises that finance to tackle climate change cannot simply be part of overseas development assistance. It should not be allowed to divert money from the pledges we have already made to the poorest. And yet there's been confidential papers released from the European Union saying quite the contrary. And also within the UK, there's also been papers released to say that actually behind the scenes that they're doing quite the opposite, and their policy is quite the opposite.
Yeah.
What is the EU position on financing at the moment? Basically, aren't they saying something like 80% of this money that they're talking about is going to come from carbon markets?
Yeah, pretty much so, yeah. That's the announcement that was made in October, where the EU proposed what on the surface looked like quite a good figure, $100 billion per year to developing countries to support them with mitigation and adaptation. But then when you look behind that initial figure, what that actually comprised of, or what the EU is proposing that comprised of, was 20% from developed countries, 20 to 40% from developing country own action, and around 40% from the carbon market. Now, the fact that developing countries need this additional finance for mitigation adaptation also means that they're very unlikely to be able to provide themselves that 20 to 40% of supposed own action. So really, the EU proposal is about 80% from the carbon market and then 20% from public finance from developed countries, which is extremely inadequate. And then what's additionally concerning is, and as you've highlighted, the public financing proposals which are being put forward. The announcement which was made by Brown last week with the UK fund which was proposed, that was actually was finance which had already been announced previously. So we see the same same pots of money being announced and re-announced as if they're different, they're new and additional contributions. And then increasingly there's very big concern about double counting again of the finance which is being put forward. That's actually, a lot of it is coming from existing aid budgets. So it's money which was supposed to go to developing countries anyway being diverted, rather than the rich countries actually providing the new and additional public finance that they're committed to providing under the convention.
Okay, let's talk about solutions then.
Yeah.
Perhaps because we just talked about money, we can talk about money. I mean, all the rich countries are throwing their hands up and saying, actually, we're pretty much bankrupt. We've given it all to the banks.
Yeah.
Can they afford it out of? Can they afford the finance for the global deal out of public funds, or do we need to see things like Tobin taxes, cracking down on tax havens, and things like subsidy switches, a tax on aviation and shipping perhaps?
I think you've listed some of the really good proposals that are out there. I think that there is a significant amount of money which can be found from public funds. Simply cutting perverse subsidies from governments to things like fossil fuels would yield a significant amount of money. There's an estimate that globally government subsidies to fossil fuels are worth around $300 billion per year. So already that is a massive source of money. If re-diverted, could significantly contribute to the needs of developing countries, and also the investments that are needed in developed countries to start to reduce our emissions. And then, as you said, there are lots of innovative proposals out there. There's growing support for a tax on cross-border financial transactions, what you call a Tobin tax, and also there is potential for rich countries to raise significant revenues from using a carbon tax. There are other benefits, from a carbon tax and ways in which it's kind of more, it's a better mechanism than carbon trading for incentivizing companies to reduce emissions. There's a greater government control over the level of the tax, and it's superior to carbon trading in that way. But it can also yield quite a lot of money. So if you look at the case of Sweden has had a carbon tax in place since 1991. It introduced it at the level of 28 euros per tonne, but it's now at 128 euros per tonne. So that's had the benefit both of helping Sweden to kind of keep control of its emissions. The government claims that its emissions would be 20% higher without that, but then it's also providing significant financing for the government. We would support the introduction of a hypothecated carbon tax, where the money from the carbon tax is ring-fenced specifically to go into kind of actions to tackle climate change, either domestically or to support mitigation internationally, rather than money just going to a government pot. And obviously with carbon taxes as well, you need safeguards in place to make sure that vulnerable groups and low-income groups aren't disproportionately hit, and that's the case with the carbon tax, which is being proposed by Sarkozy in France at the moment. So there are special measures in there to recognising that people who live in rural areas obviously need to pollute more from their transport than people who live in urban areas. Looking at kind of impacts on low-income households to kind of things, actions to mitigate against those. But we think there is a lot of potential from the use of carbon taxes as well. So really there's a lot of different proposals out there. Similarly, a levy on fuels from shipping globally, and a lot of potential from that. So we really don't buy into this argument that the money isn't possible to raise that money. And as you said, the governments have shown that where they do sort of perceive a really big credible threat to public interest and public security, as they did in the banking crisis, they were able to mobilise the funds. So we'd like to see the same level of commitment, but for climate change, which has shown, it's undisputed now that the cost of inaction, as pointed out in Stern's report, is far greater than the cost of action.
We'll be right back. In the run-up to the climate talks in Copenhagen, I caught up with the organisers and contributors to the C-Words exhibition at the Arnolfini Centre in Bristol. The Arnolfini has hosted 100 days of art activism addressing the themes of carbon, climate and capital, curated by the artist group Platform. I met James Marriott, a curator from Platform, who spoke about the organisation's 25-year history, art activism and the new situation he found himself in curating activist art in a public building.
Platform is an organisation which brings people together from arts and activism and education. And what we do is we bring individuals who've got different disciplines, different skills, in collaboration to create projects to do with social and ecological justice. The absolutely key driving force behind everything that we do, the common ground, in a sense, between people who have quite disparate practical skills and sometimes quite different politics, the common ground is the fact that we want to help provoke change. We want to help bring about change. And change, which is, broadly speaking, about social and ecological justice. That's the way Platform works in itself, and there are around about 10 or 12 people involved in it at any one time, working more or less on constantly, and then it works within a field of around about 50 other people who come and go, rather. And we've been working for 25 years now. Not always the same group of people, but there's a constant thread, as it were. In the mid-90s, we began to be very engaged in the question of climate and started a project in 95 or 96 called 90% Crude, which is the idea that we need to do... Well, the 90% is in relation to the fact we need to make a 90% reduction in CO2 emissions, and they're crude because of crude oil, which you can probably work out. And since that time, we've made work which is focused a lot on questions of climate justice, on questions of how it is that corporations work in the world, the impact that they make on individuals and communities, the impact they make on democracy, the impact they make on human rights, and how all of these things tie together with questions of climate change. Because we straddle both the arts and activism, we're invited at different times to do different things by different places. Yeah. And we were invited by the Arnolfini about 3 years ago now to do something with them, and we puzzled about it for a long time because we'd never done anything in a space like this on this scale. We've done little bits and bobs over the last 20 years or so in art spaces, but nothing on this scale at all. We always were keen to make it an event which would have political bite, that would, in a sense, feed into the political continuum, feed into the political moment, help drive that forward if it could. And so, as our minds cleared, we thought, okay, right, we can utilise the moment of COP to provide us, you know, we could pivot around the moment of COP, as it were. And so we brought that idea to the Arnolfini, and they thought that was great, and it sort of came out to some extent out of the conversations with them. And then they chose to put it within this program called 100 Days, which is a countdown to Copenhagen. And personally, I'm very happy about that because I feel it's a way in which the institution itself came off the shelf a bit, didn't occupy the classic position of neutrality on these things that the cultural institutions of this country tried to take. But it said basically, you know, by putting a title down, 100 days to COP, means that, yes, we're concerned about this, you know, as they bloody well should be. You know. But I'm glad that we helped that process. Maybe they would have done it without us, but I think we helped it take place. So, that said, we wanted to work in collaboration with other people to create a project which would be very live. I think one of our reservations about working in a gallery space is that we would be forced to make something which was rather dead. It was just stuck on the walls and people would wander around and it would be quiet. And, you know, you just shuffle about and eye up the person who's standing over there and think, oh, she's quite good looking, or that bloke, oh, he's not bad. But we can do more than that. Not to say that that's not fun, But we can do more of that with these public spaces. And our practice is very much focused around live activity. And in many ways, the role of the human voice, the voice of one individual speaking to another and another listening to as equals, in, as democratic citizens. So we wanted to create something which would have that liveness about it. So we interviewed, we asked a whole range of different other groups to come and collaborate with us. Virtual Migrants, one, Heather and Ackroyd and Harvey, another, the Lab of Insurrectionary Imagination, a third, the Institute for Art and Practices, Sent at Home, and so on. Mm-hmm. One of the things I think that's interesting and important about these groups is that they have overlapping concerns. They share a lot of things, but they also have differences. And we wanted to try and organise a space where those differences could exist, coexist together and try and rub off on each other, and something could come from the engagement of those differences.
Has the gallery format offered any new possibility?
Yeah, I absolutely. I think that what we've gained from the gallery is the fact that this is a public building. We think that around about 35,000 to 45,000 people will have come through the galleries over the last 8 weeks. And to be honest, my guess is around about 25 to 30,000 of them would have come whatever was happening. Because they just do. They just pass by. It's what you do on a Sunday afternoon. You go and have a look at what's going on there. And generally people go along and think, what a load of rubbish. Or, you know, but they still come back.
Of course they do.
You know, it's like walking in a park. It's what you do. So it's a bit like a street. And in some ways, or a shopping mall, or a church, or those kinds of public spaces. And that provides a very interesting context in which to do a lot of this kind of stuff. Because in some ways, much of what we're doing here could have been done in a social centre or something. But there, it wouldn't be in the gaze. First of all, it wouldn't be in the gaze. And secondly, if it was done in a social centre, you wouldn't have a space of neutrality between some of the different artist groups. And that, I think, is interesting as well. You know, there are some people here who feel more comfortable in this space than others. But largely, I think most of the groups who are here will feel equally uncomfortable in this space. You know, and that's a useful thing. Whereas if, say, for example, we'd done it in an activist social centre, some of the groups here would have felt totally at ease with that, and others so uncomfortable that they wouldn't have been able to operate in it. And it wouldn't have been viewed by the general public. Do you see what I mean?
Absolutely. So it, kind of moving into this public space is a kind of meta-narrative. It's like an integration, like with a much wider public. Yeah. And rather than presenting artworks to an audience or a group of people who might already be aware of those issues and the issues that you're raising, because you've kind of platformed yourself somewhere where, like you say, there would be passers-by who would may not even think about these things, you've opened yourself up, but that, you know, that bigger environment causes some discomfort.
Yes.
But is that a motivating discomfort? Does it drive you to think that maybe this kind of platform is something that you could work with in the future?
Yes, it is, I think. I mean, I certainly think not, you know, it's been, in many ways, it's been extremely frustrating, but it's clarified a lot of things for me, I think, and for Jane as well, who's coming in. One of which is that this is a public space, it's a public building. You paid for it, I paid for it, all the other citizens of this country paid for it. And therefore, it should be one which can be used for a diversity of practices. Mm. Vast majority of these spaces tend to be focused on providing a space in which to exhibit objects which can be sold onto the market to the highest bidder, luxury objects, which essentially are about capital stores. Mm. They are objects in which you can store capital, and they become sold at a high, ideally at a higher price. And that's whether you're talking about a Picasso or a Hearst or you know, something much more modest, as it were. Now, none of the people who are involved here are creating capital stores. Mm. It's all just ideas which are provoking. And I think that these spaces should be able to have the opportunity to show that kind of stuff and to be utilised for that kind of stuff.
I see. So what will happen to the works on show here? Will they be kept to be exhibited elsewhere, or will they be...
Okay, well, let's go through them. Yeah. Heather and Dan's work, this is a very interesting question. Heather and Dan's work, which is the Walking Forest, will be planted next Saturday.
Okay. Where's that happening?
In Bristol. In Bristol. Okay. And it'll be a wood. The bike block will be taken to Copenhagen and basically utilised to stop, you know, to be involved in a riot. And I guess in terms of ownership and future ownership, it's most likely to be owned by the Danish police. You know, sort of,
yeah.
That's probably the likely outcome. Now, whether they value it as an artwork, that's a matter for them. You know, maybe they've got a museum they put it in. I don't know. The installation, which is platforms, it'll just be cycled back to London and utilised for other work. The installation, which is the videos, pieces which are Kipriana virtual migrants, will be stuck on a website and will be available freely to everybody across the world, or anybody who's got the internet, which is not everybody, but large-ish chunks. And the work by Kipriana and Hollington, which is the post-capitalist auction. The objects will be auctioned very shortly at 5 o'clock.
Yeah.
And the money that is raised will be given to somebody to go to Copenhagen. And the objects, the objects indeed will go into private collectors' hands. But as they are just an old packet of fags and a plastic bottle, they're unlikely to be particularly useful as capital stores. Now, maybe... maybe that's...
Well, it's other people's hands. I mean, similar items have become, incredibly valuable and pointless artwork. So just a little bit on the bike block, because obviously that's going to be something that moves into Copenhagen.
Mm.
Has your experience setting up this project, knowing that it's going to be part of a direct action, has that raised any problems for you as platform?
At an early stage with the Arnolfini, we had to clarify something, and not without a fight. We clarified the fact that we would be the curators of this show, that any of the artists who are working here were effectively subcontracted by us.
Okay.
We would give them a contract, we would give them the money, and we would determine, crucially, whether or not what they made was art. It was up for us to decide whatever the bike block is doing is art, and up for us to decide what the virtual migrants is art. Okay. And that's a very important thing, because the art world, whatever that means, or the given structures of the art market system, certainly do not recognise the vast majority of people who we've got here on show as art at all. Only probably one of the 7, 8 artists who are very active here, 9 artists who are very active here, would constitute art within the frame of the given.
Yeah.
Now, from our point of view, they're all art.
Yeah.
And actually, from lots of people's point of view, they're art. And interestingly enough, as I say, 30 to 40,000 people have come through here, and only 2 people have said to me, is this really art? So the general public, they don't give a damn. Mm. It's just interesting.
Mm.
But the art systems go, oh, no, that's not art. And so the question of whether or not it's been a problem for us about using the bike block, once we'd overcome the fact that we clarified with the Arnolfini that if we would determine what was good and what was bad, then there are no problems. Before that, yes, certainly it would have been a problem.
Excellent.
And I think we learned a really important lesson there. We had to make that up as we went along, but we realised that we had to do that.
So it's good that you maintain that kind of control.
Yeah, it's crucial. Absolutely crucial.
I think it's really worked. I mean, it does have a feel of an occupation, and it doesn't feel like anything, any other show that I've been to, in my life, really.
Mm.
It does feel like walking into something that you're a part of, rather than walking into something great. That you're looking at and you're kind of detached from.
That's really nice.
And it's something I'd like to see a lot more of. I think it's the only way that we can kind of rescue. I don't know, just thinking in terms of art at the moment, but really rescue is to get more people feeling like they're a part of it and that they understand it and it's something that they're, you know, they're welcome to rather than something they're closed off from.
I mean, it's very interesting though, but one has to, we have to understand how it runs contrary to the given structures, you know. I mean, one of the things that I've done together with my colleagues is be in the gallery virtually every single day. Now, this is a particularly busy day because it's kind of coming to the end of the show and people tend to turn up at the end of shows like, oh, I must go and see that, you know. And it's a weekend and the weather's not bad. But rainy Tuesday, there's not a lot of people. But we've tried to be here every single day and go up to everybody who's coming to the gallery and say, hello, here's a free catalogue. I'd like to give you a free catalogue. It deals with the issues that we're doing here. Where have you come from? How did you get here? Why do you come here? Are you interested in this stuff? Do you like coming to the Isle of Fiend? And discussing with people endlessly. Because, as I say, we want to make a space which is alive, where the human voice, where we recognise that you have come here as an individual and you are a creative individual, just like I am, and we need to work together as citizens.
Absolutely.
But that causes a great deal of disturbance in the art structures. We were told very shortly after we started that we shouldn't be doing that in the gallery, but it made it like Dixon's, you know, like a shop. It's quite revealing.
No, absolutely.
And it's interesting. It's interesting how probably a lot of this will be completely beyond the radar of the given art conventions.
Yeah.
This won't be reviewed in the art magazines.
One of the projects that Platform has curated as part of the C-Words exhibition is the Bike Block, conceived by the Laboratory of Insurrectionary Imagination. Here, Isa, from the Lab of II, described how junk bicycles from all over Bristol are being transformed into instruments of protest, and discussed the prevailing attitude towards activist art. Okay, hi, I'm here with Isa from the Bike Block, and we're going to talk about one of the projects that's been housed at the Arnold Fini Centre. Isa, could you tell us why you are here?
We responded to the invitation from Platform to be part of the C Words, with a project that wanted to straddle Bristol and Copenhagen. The whole theme of C-Words is climate, culture, capital and carbon. So we thought that actually doing a project that would be useful for what we wanted to do in Copenhagen was very relevant. So I, as a part of the Laboratory of Insurrectionary Imagination, proposed to organise a week of workshops where anyone could participate and design a strategy as well as a prototype to build a bike block to take part in the mobilizations in Copenhagen in December, especially to support and facilitate the December the 16th Action Day, which is Reclaim Power, which is called Reclaim Power, and is about transforming the climate change summit into a climate justice people summit. So the aim of the bike block is to support that. So we don't know exactly what the role and the... Well, we know that the function of the bike block is going to be supporting the mobilisation. We don't know exactly yet what the ministry of the strategy is going to be, but what we've been doing here is do a lot of skill sharing in welding, bike engineering, street strategy, protest, group building. We spent the first 3 days building the group, exchanging information, plotting, designing the prototype. And since Friday morning, we've been busy building the prototype. So maybe it's possible to hear in the background the noise of the angle grinder.
So we can describe it. Outside the Arnold Fini Centre on the harbour side, there's a big, like a shipping container. And inside that container, the Laboratory of
Insurrectionary Imagination.
Insurrectionary
Imagination has created a workshop where bike hackers and welders have come together. But what exactly are they building?
They're building, for the moment, the two prototypes that they're building are one that is called the Double Double Trouble, which is two tall bikes made of two frames on top of each other that are going to be turned into a chariot. So there'll be a platform in between to be able to carry people or food or compost toilets or hot drinks or whatever people want to carry. And in parallel, there is another prototype, which is add-ons. So we've been trying to think of bits that would be useful for the bike rock that could be added onto existing bikes. The Double Double Trouble is very much for discarded and recycled bicycles that people are collecting currently in Copenhagen for us. The add-ons prototype is more about what can we add to existing bikes to take part. So there will be, for instance, pegs to be added to the back wheel axle so that one bicycle can end up carrying two people, flagpoles, this kind of thing, map holders. This is what is being played with at the moment.
So upstairs in one of the main exhibition spaces, there's lots of designs on the walls. Have they been designs that members of the public have suggested? Have they been designs that people who are working on the bike block have suggested? How have those ideas come about?
Yeah, a bit of both. There was an installation. We basically set up the bike block installation on the weekend of the 15th of November, and it stayed open as an installation without workshops taking place for a whole week, during which any member of the public was invited to suggest designs, and quite a few did. Then some designs have been worked upon during the last week of workshops. And I think that what is also interesting to explain is that one of the galleries in the Arnolfini has effectively been transformed into a bike workshop.
Yeah.
So it was really interesting for us to explore what an art gallery is, and we feel that it should not be a white cube where we're not about, it's not about talking or touching, but actually reclaim it as a public space where people can interact and play. And so this is what effectively we've been doing, and we're very grateful for Platform and Arnolfini to have facilitated that.
And it's definitely worked. It does feel like an occupation, which is something that you don't. I don't walk into galleries now and feel like I'm a part of something. I feel like I'm something that's looking at something, and I'm something that has to be distinct from whatever's on the walls or on the floor in order to understand it. Whereas at the Arnolfini, it's very much a sense of the only way to get what's happening here is to be involved in it. Like, your involvement is absolutely necessary. And I think that comes through in the bike block piece as well. Just the fact that, I mean, are these bikes that you've collected, and in Copenhagen, have they been collected, or are people donating bikes? Like, it's almost like urban agriculture, like harvesting the city for
absolutely,
all these.
Absolutely.
It's a lovely idea.
In Bristol, we've been really helped by the Bristol Bike Project, the Life Cycle Project, the Spoken Chain Project. It's also a city which is heaving with bicycle projects, and a lot of them have been immensely supportive by giving us a lot of old bicycles, bike parts, bike stands, lending tools. So it's also the kind of project that is very much about reminding that artists are nothing if they're not part of the community, and that here it really feels that this project is about saying, yeah, there is a whole world of DIY culture that has so much creativity that is never really honoured in this kind of contemporary art centre. And we're really pleased that this has created a space to really honour their creativity, and the support of the local projects in Bristol has been amazing.
That's excellent. And I think it is really important to stress that about kind of platforms like what they presented here, because it is very unconventional. And, you know, to try and think about it in terms of like the art world and what people think a gallery is for, like, you know, yet again a group of activists, like Conscious Mind of activists, have actually come into a space and really challenged the definitions of what it is. And, you know, this is the kind of thing that, you know, a graduate from Central St. Martin's might dream of, is being able to like change what people think a gallery is, and this has just happened, you know, like as a matter of like it's such ease, and it's done, it's just been done so simply here.
Although it hasn't been, I think, done with that much ease. I think that there was a lot of work. It involved a lot of negotiations. But I think that one thing that I forgot to say, which is shameful on my part, is that the bike block is a collaboration between the Laboratory of Insurrectionary Imagination and Climate Camp. So there are loads of climate campers who are here already that have come to get involved. A lot of climate campers that are going to go to Copenhagen and take part in the bike block. So I think that's important. Then that what is important to you, or what is probably interesting in this context to talk about, is the fact that the bike block was invited by the Center for Contemporary Art in Copenhagen to be part of a show called Rethink, which is all about the emergency of the situation and rethink what climate change is. And interestingly enough, when the curator clocked that when we were talking about civil disobedience, it was not a gesture in the gallery, we actually meant it. We really meant like going onto the streets. She pulled out. She felt that she could not, and I think that she genuinely wanted the bike block to happen, but she realized that basically she could not keep her own position and her own institution safe from criticism and support us, so she pulled out. So, and then a group of artists proposed their space, which is a very interesting space because they reclaim abandoned petrol stations and transform them into art centers. And said, we have one, we've secured one in Copenhagen, we're currently redoing it, transforming it, and you'll be welcome. And yet again, when they realized that we were taking part and supporting the Reclaim Power action, and that we really were very open to the fact that we would take part in civil disobedience, that the bike block was about being a tool of resistance, they pulled out again. So we actually had two examples of the arts institution, the art world, very much having the discourse of doing political work and taking climate change seriously and doing something about it, that actually got terrified when it meant actively supporting action and thought, no, we can only talk about it. We can't actually support the action. So the people in Copenhagen who have steadily supported the bike block have been a legal social centre called the Candy Factory, to whom we are so very grateful, because is that they, the first time when the Contemporary Art Centre pulled down, they said, well, you can come here. And then when the abandoned petrol station said, well, you can have our space, I said, well, you know what, for the bike block, an abandoned petrol station would be great. They're like, that's fine. And then when the other, you know, when the abandoned petrol station group pulled out and we said, well, would you have us still? They were like, yeah, sure. So it's been an interesting process. And in that sense, the work that the laboratory tries to do, which is always trying to make the world of art and the world of activism meet, try to have the creativity of the art world meeting the courage and the audaciousness of the activist world, meet and create and reclaim cultural and art institutions. In Copenhagen, this has been a lot more difficult. Whole thing has been an interesting process.
I wonder, it would be interesting to know whether or not the Arnolfini Centre would, if, for example, the COP15 talks were happening in Bristol and it was BRI15, has there ever been the question raised?
Yes.
There has been. And yes. What was the response to that?
Definitely not.
Right, so
that's... So that's here you go. That's,
yeah, okay. So it's a trait of the art world.
Absolutely.
Okay.
It's like, it's fine to talk about it, but not. And interestingly, there's been a little bit of media interest in the fact that some of the artists that have been taking part in C-Words have said, yes, I'm going to use my fee to go to Copenhagen, or for us to say, yeah, we're using our fees. And there's a whole article in The Guardian about, you know, is it legitimate that artists, or that the art council funding ends up funding civil disobedience.
I thought that was a lovely lead. I thought it's such a nice thread that runs through it, how that money's being recycled. yeah.
I think well, as far as I'm concerned, that's the sign of democracy. We keep being told that we live in a democracy, and it's like just the fact that seems so shocking for me is a very strong signifier that there is nothing democratic in this whole system, and that I think that it's the institution, the media institutions, and the governments that forget that everything we take for granted was acquired through civil disobedience. But the very fact that there is now money, public money, to go to the art, that was won through civil disobedience, through direct action. Absolutely. So, and I think that that's something that the lab and Climate Camp are very keen to reclaim.
And it will be reclaimed on the 16th of December.
December, yes.
Yeah, so definitely. I look forward to it, and we'll have to catch up then to kind of see how it's been carried out.
Yeah, we'll see you at the Candy Factory.
Absolutely.
The coal face of climate change, the front edge of climate change, the billion people who depend on water from the glaciers, their farms and their water and their livelihoods, the hundreds of millions of people who need coral reefs to provide the ecosystems so they can have food on their plates at the end of the day, the billions of people who live in the marginal lands, the deltas around the world, where they do their farming, they get washed away as climate change washes away their farms. So we're marching shoulder to shoulder, but more importantly, we're standing shoulder to shoulder with the poorest people in this world, the people on the front line of climate change. Today, there's one person amongst us who isn't standing shoulder to shoulder with the poorest people in the world. Ed Miliband, the Secretary of State for Energy and Climate Change, is marching today. But he's advocating policy changes that will devastate the lives of those people around the world, that will wipe out their existence potentially. He's saying that it's okay for the EU to cut its carbon emissions by 30% by 2020. But he knows the science. He knows that only gives a 50% chance of avoiding dangerous climate change. We say to Mr. Miliband, 50% chance, a 50-50 chance might be great if you're backing a horse at Epsom, but if it's about saving the lives of billions of people around the world, 50-50 isn't good enough. We need to do more. Ed Miliband says the way to solve this crisis is through the carbon markets. But we know carbon markets don't work. We've seen within Europe an emissions trading scheme that has made millions of pounds to the traders but done nothing to cut carbon. We say to Mr. Miliband, carbon trading won't save the earth. It'll put those lives of those farmers and those fisher folk in jeopardy. We need real policies to deliver real change and real carbon cuts. Mr. Miliband says that saving the Kyoto Protocol isn't a red line issue for the European Union. We can find some other way of reaching agreement. We say the Kyoto Protocol must live. Hundreds of thousands of people around the world fought for a strong Kyoto Protocol because it gave binding targets on rich countries. It made them accountable for what they were going to do. There were sanctions if they failed to meet those targets. We don't want some wishy-washy deal just to keep the Americans on board. We need a strong climate change agreement. We need the Kyoto Protocol commitments, Mr. Miliband. And lastly, and as importantly, Mr. Miliband will say the private sector will give them money to help save the climate crisis. He says that we'll need £100 billion to help developing countries, and most of that will come from the private sector. We know that's a lie. We know that's a con. The private sector won't put their hands in their pockets to sort out climate change. They haven't here. They won't across the rest of the world. As Paul Brannan from Christian Aid said earlier, the Industrial Revolution started here. Climate change started here. We need to see rich countries like the UK putting our hands in our pockets and helping fund developing countries so they can adapt to climate change and they can have clean development. And lastly, where we differ with Mr. Miliband is he's a great champion of offsetting. carbon offsetting, letting the fag hats in America and in the UK and across the rest of Europe off from tackling climate change by being able to offset their emission overseas. Again, we know offsetting's a cut, a con, and it won't deliver climate change cuts in emissions. So we're walking, we're marching shoulder to shoulder here today, and we're marching shoulder to shoulder with the poorest people in the world. That's what this protest is about. Let's keep marching until we win, because it's not just our lives at stake, it's the poorest people in the world who've done least to cause climate change. And if you see Mr. Miliband today, tell him that. No half chances, no half-baked deals. We're here to deliver real change, to deliver real promise for those people across the world. Thank you.